Well, it's a great privilege to be here this morning in a whole host of ways for me. First of all, I think this is about the fourth time I've been able to do this Bible forum, and it's become a real blessing to me. I think it's one of the great things that happens among our brethren in this country, and thank you, congregation here, for having such a thing. Secondly, this particular year is especially meaningful for me because you allowed me to invite my son to participate with me in this. That's a first for the two of us to get to work together in this series. And I hope you saw that why I wanted him here. Pretty amazing. Benjamin is a great musician, but he's also studied a lot of what goes behind music. And you surely saw the testimony of God in music. And let me just ask you, those of you that have been here Thursday night and Friday night, had you ever heard anything like that before? Raise your hand if you had. But basically very little, right? Because that's just not a subject we've dealt with very much in this area. So it's a special privilege. And Benjamin, I'm proud of the work you did and look forward to hoping many more times like this. I'm putting the pressure on him in front of everybody. So I really hope that this becomes an experience, because I get invited to do these things a good bit. And I'm going to be inviting him too. And the third reason is I love you folks. And this church stands out as a beacon to me in lots of reasons. You have a pretty good preacher, for one. And Scott puts himself down a lot, but you know what kind of a man he is and what a good job he does. And it's a pleasure to get to work with you again. And he's about married off all his kids. I can't even believe that. Still three to go. Well, that's good. And then there's so many in this church that are special to us. And there's some new folks here today and that I had not met before, and thank you for being here and being so diligent and faithful in your attendance. But this church is a beacon as far as I'm concerned. So I wanted to say a few things by way of introduction and just offer my thanks for the privilege of being here. All right, let's see. Right off the bat, we have a message up there. Okay. Just click OK. Well, what if it's not OK with me? Okay. Did that do it? Okay. I want to say also, as Benjamin did, Sam, when there's technology, if we don't have a techie guy to help us, we're in big trouble. And as you saw already in this series, something invariably happens that you didn't expect. So you need a Sam to fix it. So we're counting on you, partner. I want no problems this morning. Because I'm old, and I don't know how to handle these techie problems. If I can't just click and go, I'm in trouble. So, now, the last thing I want to say by way of introduction is, this is Saturday morning. I mean, you knew that, I hope. But this is not typical for a Saturday morning. I mean, do you usually do this kind of thing on Saturday morning? I don't think so. So, I don't allow sleeping. And I'm watching you. And I can see you very well. I've been doing this a long time. So if you start doing this, then I'm going to make you stand up. And we'll do a little bit of this and get you waked up. So don't be surprised, because I don't allow it. I want your attention, folks. This is too important not to have your attention. And so you kids, you stayed up half the night last night? Too bad. You're not going to sleep through this lecture. All right, you see the title for this lesson, and I would say it's the title for this series, Origins. Is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? I like that title because lots of folks in our age would say, no, it is not reasonable. The more we learn about the natural world and the more we understand how it functions, the less we need God. And I was told back before the flood and when I was in college that you folks who are believers in God better get over it. Because we're going to reach a point where we know how to explain things, and the only reason God has been posed in the past is because we were filling in the gaps of our ignorance. And so God is a God of the gaps. And the less gaps, the less you need God. Very common conception. And I would say to you, the exact opposite is true. The more we learn, the more powerful are the reasons for believing in God. So I'm going to tell you that at the beginning, and we'll say it again at the end. It is absolutely reasonable, and I hope you come to believe that. And I make no apology for being feisty and emphatic, because you get plenty of that on the other side of this issue. So I make no apology for that. So this morning, I want to talk about design at the microscopic level. The subtitle is The Signature in the Cell, and you'll see why that is in a minute. This morning and tomorrow morning during the class time, we're going to look at the microscopic level. Tomorrow night, we're going to look at the macroscopic level. I'm telling you, don't miss any of those. And if you do, get Sam to help you and get the video and listen to it. This is a series, and the power of it rests in the series, not just one lesson. So I'll start this way in this lecture. This came from the website for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, the Center for SETI Research. So this is a direct quote from their website. Sam helped me get to it last night. So I want to read you this first sentence. SETI. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is an exploratory science. So may I interrupt my quote here again and tell you, we're talking science in this lecture. SETI says we are an exploratory science. Why do they say that? Because they're using the methods of science to investigate this subject. That seeks evidence of life in the universe. And by the way, in another section of their website, they say intelligence in the universe, which is the subject of this series, right? By looking for some signature of its technology. And then the next paragraph says, our current understanding of life's origin on Earth suggests that given a suitable environment and sufficient time, life will develop on other planets. I mean, that's just said as blithely as if we understand all this, folks. You know, in our understanding of life now, surely this happens somewhere else. Because it's relatively easy, is what's implied here. Relatively easy. It makes me angry for people to make such statements. May I revise that statement? Our current understanding of life's origin on Earth is we don't have a clue how life originated on Earth naturally. In the 50s and 60s, when I was in high school and in college, the concept was very widespread then. We're going to figure out in the next short period of time how life evolved, and we don't need God. And the origin of life stuff that was being presented then, every bit of it has now been debunked. And here we are 50 years later. They have less concept now how life originated on Earth than they did 50 years ago. They are totally lost. And they still make stupid statements like that. Pardon me. Whether evolution will give rise to intelligent technological civilizations is open to speculation. They just got through saying, from what we know about the understanding of life's origins, if there's a suitable environment and enough time, it's going to happen. But whether it be intelligent and technological, I guess, is open to speculation. So why are they looking? Because they believe with all their heart it's happened in lots of places. However, such a civilization could be detected across interstellar distances and may actually offer our best opportunity for discovering extraterrestrial life in the near future. SETI's been in existence since the 1960s and earlier. When I was at Harvard, my astronomy professor was a part of this organization. He was a world-renowned radio astronomer, and he was part of the group looking for signs of intelligent life in the universe. And I can tell you they believed with all their heart there were thousands, if not millions, of them in our own Milky Way galaxy. So they knew they were going to find something. But they haven't. May I say to you, there's not one scintilla of evidence, respectable evidence, that there's any civilizations anywhere else in this universe. Don't believe the little green men stories and the UFOs. It's a bunch of hoopla. These are scientists looking. Why do I go there? Look what they said. An exploratory science that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. So I ask you, may I call you my class? I ask you, class, are they using science to look for signs of intelligence and design? Yes, they are. That's what they're doing. Does anybody fuss about that being science? No. But when I do it as a believer in God, say I'm looking for signs of intelligence and intelligent design in the universe, I'm said to be unscientific. Because I'm proposing God, and God can't be examined by science. Well, they're right about that. God cannot be. That's not the argument. Can we look for signs of intelligent design in nature by using science? Even though by science you can never see or observe God, can you look for signs of intelligent design? Can you see this, class? That I will tell you, in the court case in Ohio some years ago where intelligent design was put on trial, the judge says it's ruled out because it's not science, because it proposes an entity which cannot be observed. You think there's anything about the general theory of evolution that can't be observed? But here's an organization that's looking in the realm of science for evidence there's intelligence out there. And I say, amen. I have no problem with what they're doing. I think it's fine. I say, why can't we do it right here on Earth also? And look for signs of intelligence right here using the methods of science. Virtually all radio SETI experiments have looked for what are called narrow band signals. These are radio emissions that are at one spot on the radio dial. Narrow band signals, please note this carefully, I highlighted it, are the mark of a purposely built transmitter. Natural cosmic noisemakers such as pulsars, quasars, do not make radio signals that are this narrow. You know, there's all kinds of signals out in space. I mean, Benji could talk about this. And I wish I had time to show you all the diagrams of this stuff. The kind of noise that is made out there in outer space by regular noisemakers is a mess. If you found in the midst of that mess a narrow band radio signal that contained information, everybody on Earth would say, whoa! That had to come from an intelligent source because nature doesn't do that. This is not me talking. I'm telling you what they're looking for. Radio signals that are narrow band that contain information. And I will tell you, if they ever found such a signal, it would be in every headline of every newspaper on the face of the earth. And the message would be, we have the first indication of an intelligent civilization out there. I know that because in my class at Harvard in 1968, they found a signal they thought was one of those. And it got blasted until they realized there were about 68,000 of those same signals, and they decided nature did that one. So the bottom line of this experiment, ladies and gentlemen, is they have not found one scintilla of evidence of any signs of intelligence out there yet. And after 25 years of paying for it, you paid for that for 25 years, did you know that? Your taxes. The Congress voted them out because they hadn't found one single thing. Are they still looking? Yes, by private funding. And they will continue, I'm sure. If they were to find something, they would be able to infer intelligent cause without identifying what that intelligence is. I'm pausing on purpose. I want you to think about that. Do you get it? If they found a signal from outer space that's narrow band and has information in it, there isn't a human being alive that wouldn't say that came from an intelligence source. Do they have any clue what that intelligence is like? No, it's light years away. But they would have no problem concluding that it came from an intelligent source. So don't tell me that just because science cannot investigate God, you can't propose God as the intelligent source. You want to know more about him, you're going to have to go to this book, not science. I've spent too long on this, but folks, this is one of the most important points we'll make all weekend long. It is not unscientific to propose intelligent design. If you don't get anything else out of this series, I hope you get that. SETI is doing it all the time. And so are lots of other scientists. What do you think they're doing when they find some rock in Africa near a bunch of bones and they decide, is that rock something that could have happened by natural causes? Or did some intelligence act on that rock and so it's a tool? Anybody see him back there making that tool? But can they infer the rock could not have gotten in that shape unless somebody messed with it? That they're doing that all the time. That's conclusion or inference to design, folks. It's not unscientific. I had one guy say in one of these lectures I did where I had more evolutionists present than believers. He said, yes, but you're talking about human intelligence in that case, and that's part of nature. I said, sir, what you just said makes me furious because you're just misleading your students that are sitting here in this class. That is the whole issue. Where did human intelligence come from? Who says it's part of nature? Where did it come from? That's the whole issue. And now you want to just slough it off? That's just part of nature. The whole argument is, did it require intelligence to produce this? Okay. So what if we received a message from outer space that had a language in it that we could decode and read? What do you think? I will tell you, there wouldn't be any headline anywhere that didn't have that in it. And the conclusion would be somebody intelligent out there trying to tell us something. And what if the language said, help, come find me? By the way, that has not happened. But are there signs of intelligent design right here on earth? Absolutely there are. So before I go there, I want to read the one passage of Scripture. When I do this in a church building, I don't make any hesitation to use this book. But if I'm in a chemistry classroom or in a college lecture hall, I don't use this book. I believe wholeheartedly this is God's word, but that's another whole subject. Romans 1 verse 20 says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." So get this, Bible believers in this audience. The Bible says you can learn God exists without the Bible by examining the evidence of the natural world. You can see God, who cannot be observed, by seeing things that are made. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the argument from design, which is what Benjamin and I are using all weekend. Always the strongest argument for the existence of God from the natural world. So are there signs of intelligent design right here on earth? Well, I should say, every living cell is full of them, including a language which we've learned to decode and read. We know exactly what it's doing, I say, within limits. We continue to learn more things all the time. That's why I think Anthony Flew, professor of philosophy, former atheist, author, and debater in 2004 at the age of 80, having spent his life debating and making fun of creationists, said, "It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design." And so Flew says, "The research on DNA was too much for me. I give up." He is a believer now. I don't know if Anthony Flew is still alive. He was 80 years old in 2004, so what does that make him? 93, something like that. But he became a believer in his old age. I appreciate a person who, after a lifetime of disbelieving, finally admitted that the evidence of the natural world is enough. There has to be a God. Now, he never accepted the God of the Bible, as far as I know. But I appreciate him for being that honest. So, I'm going to introduce you to a book that I like very much. It's called Signature in the Cell, DNA, and the Evidence for Intelligent Design by Stephen C. Meyer. It's powerfully good. It's sitting right there on the end of that table. It's about that thick. Most people shy away from books that thick. Every page is important. This man is a philosopher of science. He's a scientist. He's a well-studied and well-researched individual. And he covers the bases as of 2009. It's powerfully good. And the title is no mistake. Signature. You remember what SETI said? They're looking for some signature of its technology. He takes a play off of that. And what he's arguing is the cell has a signature in it that says somebody made this. And then he proceeds to explain why, with lots of contradiction and problems from scientists who've critiqued him up and down one side and down up one side and down the other. But he stands strong. So a lot of what I'm going to talk to you about comes from that book and many others. By the way, I'm going to provide Scott with a bibliography again at the end of this series. We'll add some of Benji's stuff to it. And So everything we're telling you today, please, since this is out on Facebook and everybody can go attack, I will be happy to provide you the actual source of everything I'm saying. I don't make this stuff up. And certainly most of it's not original with me, hardly any of it. I read a lot. And I don't mind telling you right where it came from. And most of these things will have references on them. So here's the question, class. Which is more reasonable? We're going to look at the evidence of the natural world as it relates to DNA. And then we're going to ask you the question, which is more reasonable, natural causes or intelligent design? Those are your only two choices. There are no other choices. DNA and all that it does either came about by natural causes or it was designed by somebody. There aren't any other choices. If you know of another one, I'd like to hear it. I've been doing this for 60 years now. I have yet to have anybody tell me any other option. It's either natural causes or somebody designed it. And you're going to be the judge. And if you sit in most college classes today in biology, in chemistry, in physics, in psychology, you will be told it came about by natural causes. Can they support that notion? I say absolutely not. But you're going to have to be the judge. So, let's talk about life at its simplest level. And may I please express apology to all living things for saying the word simplest in the same context. There is no such thing as simple life. The simplest forms of living things are so massively complex, it's beyond our comprehension and beyond our ability to express it. But all living things have certain things in common. Structural materials. That's the proteins that are assembled from amino acids. They're the construction, the shape, and mobility of living things. Every living thing has to have something like that. Secondly, the tools and machinery. We call those enzymes. Enzymes are just special forms of proteins. So these first two components are both proteins, class. The structural materials and the tools and machinery. What do the tools and machinery do? They provide for the growth and maintenance of living things. If we stopped right there, class, there would be no living things. Period. There is no living thing made up of just proteins. It could not survive. And one of the main reasons for that is living things reproduce themselves. Proteins can't do that. So there's another major class, we call it the blueprints. They're the genes and the nucleic acids, the DNA and the RNA, that are fit for reproduction. They contain the information and the directive function for every living thing. Now please, I want to say to you again, anytime you make something as simplified as that, there are 38,000 things you left out. Please. It's not that simple, but the basics are there. Proteins and nucleic acids. Every living thing has them. So let me pause a minute here and tell you the evolutionist explanation of that. I like to be fair about this. How do you explain that all living things, from simple single-celled organisms all the way up to elephants and us, pardon me for putting those in the same category, have the same kind of chemistry? Why is that from an evolutionist standpoint? They say it's because we all came from a common ancestry way back millions and millions of years ago in the ocean, where we all were formed by natural causes from simple molecules and eventually evolved into who we are. We all have the common tree of life, which is why we have a common chemistry. That is not a stupid answer, class. That is one possible explanation for the common chemistry of living things. That's not a stupid answer. What's my answer as a believer in intelligent design? I would argue that if an intelligent designer is going to build a system that interplays with each other, why would they not have a common chemistry? In other words, if I'm going to eat beef, it better be beef that my body can absorb and my chemistry will work on that beef. And the same is true for every other thing. They're all interplaying. Why wouldn't a designer design it so we'd all have a common chemistry? That doesn't answer that question, does it? But it is a fact that all living things have these commonalities. And it goes way beyond that. The question is, how'd that happen? And which is the more reasonable explanation? So I'm going to talk for just a few minutes about proteins, just enough to tease you and to let me talk about the next subject. There are two basic types of proteins, structural and enzymes. I already said that. And you're so sharp you remember that. And by the way, you're not allowed to forget anything. So when we get to the finish, all of it falls into place. And here, class, you have before you the 20 common amino acids occurring in all proteins in all living things. Now, again, may I say there's some exceptions to that? And I've had medical students tell me, no, Dr. Payne, there are a few things out there that have other amino acids than these common 20. So I make my disclaimer, but I will tell you 99.9% of proteins in all living things are made of these 20. So let's go through them, will you? And tomorrow we'll have a quiz. If you were in my chemistry class, you would memorize these. They're only the one of the most fundamental things in all living things. You think it's important? Do you see up here? There is the name, the abbreviation, and the chemical structure of each one of these. And I want to show you some things that are common to all these amino acids. What does amino mean? It means there's a nitrogen group in there. So do you see there's a nitrogen group right there? You know, NH3 is called an amine. Well, there's in every one of them, isn't there? NH3, you see that? All of these have an NH3 group. That's why they're called amino. What makes them an acid? I'll show you. See that COO group there? That's a carbon bonded to two oxygens. This is a double bond. That's a single bond. It's got a slightly negative end. But notice every one of them has a COO. Do you see that? That means they're cool. COO, CO. You see that? So, class, in my class in chemistry, you would memorize all the names, all the abbreviations, and all the chemical structures. And we'd have a quiz on it every day until you got them all right. Why is that important? Because we're going to build on that for the rest of the course. That's why. So, I know you're sharp. You got all those 20? Glycine, alanine, valine, leucine, isoleucine, proline, serine, threonine, aspartic acid, asparagus. No. Asparagine. But asparagus sounds better. Every protein is a combination of these 20. Here's a good way to remember that. In English, we have 26 letters, don't we? A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. There's 26 letters. And every word you make in English is a combination of those 26, isn't it? Can you make up any word in English without using one of those or some combination of those 26 letters? No. So proteins are made up of 20 amino acids in chains. Okay? You got it? And of course, you've memorized the 20, so we're ready to move now. But I want to talk about the other great class of molecules, the DNA and the RNA. These are called the nucleic acids. So what I've just told you about proteins is all I'm going to talk about proteins. And I please accept my apology, proteins, for the inadequate, incomplete treatment. You deserve two semesters. But I want to talk about RNA and DNA because they're the signature in the cell. And Dr. Francis Crick, anybody know who that is? Can you tell me? Or is he allowed to speak out? Can you tell me who Francis Crick was? He was. He's the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. Francis Crick and James Watson. Anybody know what year that was that they discovered it? Actually, it was a long time coming, and all they did was put the last pieces in place and got full credit for it, which is what happens so many times. Anybody know what year? 1953. I was 8. I'll never forget it. They got the Nobel Prize in 1957 for having discovered that structure. It only changed the whole world, folks. Since the discovery of the structure of DNA, our understanding of life at the chemical level has been completely revolutionized. We have learned more about life at the biochemical level in the last 60 years than in all of mankind's existence. And Francis Crick helped lay the foundation for that. In his little book, what I've just been telling you, Life Itself, he said everything I've told you right now. And he said this, I want to be very clear, he said this, not I. He said DNA and RNA are the dumb blondes of the biochemical world. Fit mainly for reproduction, but not able to do much other valuable work. He said that. So I apologize to every blonde in this audience. But it makes something you'll never forget. You see, DNA and RNA are great for reproduction, but not much else. Proteins do all the work. RNA and DNA provide the information and the ability to reproduce. You have to have them both. And Dr. Francis Crick's comment on that, on page 72 of his little book, Life Itself, is, this makes the origin of the explanation of evolution of life much more difficult. Because there are these two great classes of molecules that both have to be present, functioning together in any living thing. You can't do it without them. So how in the world did that all happen? Because they all have to be working together to make life work. And then do you know what Dr. Crick did in that book? Don't believe me. You go get it for yourself. Life Itself by Dr. Francis Crick. Co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. Nobel Prize winner. He spends the last 6 chapters in that book describing how somebody sent the first living things to Earth on a spaceship. He called it directed panspermia. I'm going to put it in common English. Somebody out there sent life here first on a spaceship. Folks, is there one scintilla of evidence for anything like such a thing? No, sir. But we're not letting God's foot in the door. Anything but God is okay. And if you think that's unique to that situation, you haven't read much. If the Nobel Prize winner for the structure of DNA can make such a foolish book as that, anybody can. I'm going to ask you, class, you know why he said that? Because he can't imagine even in 4 billion years enough time on Earth to produce anything like this. So it had to come from somewhere else. Well, does that help anything? How did it happen out there, folks? And by the way, where'd you get that civilization? And by the way, there's so many more questions. I was reading this morning in that book, Signature in the Cell. He said, some of this reminds him of Dr. Seuss. You remember there was a cat in the hat? Came to town, came to the house, messed up the whole house. In this particular story, he came in and took a bath in their tub and left a pink ring. And nobody wants a pink ring. So he tried to clean up the pink ring, and all it did was spread pink everywhere. So he took his hat off and introduced 6 more cats who also spread pink everywhere, and they left the biggest mess. And Meyer's point is, the guys trying to explain the origin of life are like leaving pink messes everywhere. And they're looking for the voom. Because at the end of that book, in Dr. Seuss's book, one of the cats came along and invented a voom. V-O-O-M. And what was it good for? Cleaning up pink messes. So they voomed all the pink out of existence. He said, that's what these guys are all looking for. They're looking for the voom. And they ain't found it. And in the meantime, they're spreading pink mess everywhere. All they're doing is shifting around and shifting the pink from here to there. You say somebody out there sent it. Look, folks, that hadn't solved anything. So may I talk to you about DNA for a few minutes? It has a certain characteristic structure. You see that? It's a double helix. It's got two strands wrapped around each other in a helical shape with crossbars. You see the little crossbars in here connecting the two strands. And because of that, it has the capacity to reproduce itself. Crick and Watson's great breakthrough was figuring out this structure and how it is that this thing can allow living things to reproduce, to copy themselves, and continue on. I always feel like when I get to this piece, I need 6 weeks. Now I've got 2 minutes. You see, the DNA unzips and exposes two sides. On each side, there's a set of chemicals. You may notice along here, C-A-T-G-A-C-A-C-G-G-A-T-T-G-A, and so on. Do you notice there's only four letters in there? A, T, G, and C? That's because in DNA language, there are only four letters. Those are bases that have certain chemical characteristics. If you were in my class, you'd be memorizing the names of them, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, and their chemical structure. You'd also be memorizing that one always goes with another. It's like horse and marriage. No, horse and carriage and love and marriage. Notice here, when there's a C over here, there's a G over here. When there's an A over here, there's a U over here. The U replaces the T. So A and T love each other, and G and C love each other. You know why that is, class? Because of their chemistry. G and C just fit together. It's just great. And A and T fit together. But they don't fit with the other one. And what we've learned, class, is that those four letters in a string form a sentence. And we know exactly what it means. So there is a language. This particular language has only three-letter words. That'd be a simple language, wouldn't it? And, but, the, was, every word is three letters. And it's some combination of these four. Now, if you were in my class, we'd do a little math right here. If you have four things to use, and you can use in three places all four letters, any of the four in any of the places, you can repeat, how many words can you make? Four things taken three at a time with repeat aloud. That's a combination problem, isn't it? If you've had probability. Well, let me tell you how to do it. How many letters can you put in the first place? Four. How many in the second place? Four. How many in the third place? Four. So how many altogether? Four times four times four. So do the math. Four times four times four is 64. There are exactly 64 words in DNA language. And we've learned all this since 1953. In fact, most of this was known by the early 60s when I was in college and later at Harvard in the master's program. This was all being exploded out there. And I'm telling you, they were heady people. They said, we're beginning to figure out everything there is to know about life. And I'll tell you, 50 years later, we know less about how life got started than we knew then because it is so complex. And incredible. Well, this thing unzips. Do you see that little blob right there? That's called RNA polymerase. Let me give you another hint, class. If it ends in A-S-E, it's an enzyme. And you already know an enzyme is a protein. May I ask for choral readings in here? Is that okay? I'm telling you again, if it ends in ASC, that's an enzyme, and an enzyme is a special case of a
protein.
Thank you. Let's do it one more time. An enzyme is a special case of a
protein.
Good. And let me tell you this, class, I'm going to ask you some questions in the next few minutes. The answer to every one of them is protein. So when I ask you, say it. Now, if I throw in a question that isn't, I'll try to warn you. RNA polymerase is a protein. In fact, it's a glob of lots of proteins. And it rides along the DNA to allow it to unzip and expose a side which can then be copied. The copy is the exact mirror image of what's on here, and it's called RNA. In fact, this particular one is called messenger RNA. It's a copy of what's on the DNA that can be taken and used somewhere else to build stuff. There's so much more on this one picture, but that's all I'm going to say right now. We don't have time. But here is the language that we have discovered. It's called the genetic code. I told you every word is only three letters. So here's letter number one. Here's letter number two. Here's letter number three. And you can display all 64 words on one page. It's called the genetic code. So let me teach you to read this, okay? If the first letter is U, and by the way, on RNA, the T I told you about, thymine, becomes uracil. And you say, why is that? And I say, give me another 2 days and I'll lecture on that. I mean, I need 2 days. But uracil in RNA replaces thymine in the DNA, okay? So if the first letter is U and the second letter is U and the third letter is U, you have the word U, U, U. And if you pronounce that word, it would be ooh. But this is a non-spoken language. The question is, what does OO mean? I'll tell you what it means. It means phenylalanine. And I know that's very helpful. OO means phenylalanine. Let's try another one. How about U-G-A? U-G-A. That's OOGA. Now, what does OOGA mean? It means stop. Let's try another one. How about C-U-G? That's CUG. That means leucine. Is anybody starting to get it? I asked you to memorize the 20 common amino acids a few minutes ago, and I said you're not allowed to forget anything. What you see before you on the screen, class, is all 20 amino acids coded for in the DNA. In fact, there's some repeats here. There's four leucines right there. C-U-U, C-U-C, C-U-A, and C-U-G all are leucine. There's only 20 common amino acids. How many words can we make in this language? 64. So there are repeats. Looks to me like a backup system. Somebody planned. But the fact is, all the 20 common amino acids are coded in the genetic code. There's a three-letter word for each one. In fact, there's multiple three-letter words for each one. Plus, there's a code that says, start reading! That's A-U-G. And then there are three codes up here that say, stop reading. Those are called terminators. Don't you like that word? Terminator. Now, what they mean is, when you get on your chain here, this is where you stop reading. So there's a place on that chain, the DNA chain, where you start reading. You read three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, three-letter word, until you come to a terminator, and you stop reading. And between those two, class, is a string of amino acids, which everybody knows makes a
protein.
Perfect. So what's coded on the DNA is a strand which codes for building proteins.
Protein.
Thank you. Good man. So here's my question. What if we received a message from space containing just the genetic code? In other words, a page that has this on it. What do you think SETI would say? Isn't it interesting how the stars bleeped out the genetic code? Nobody would say that. Everybody on Earth would say, there's somebody intelligent out there. That didn't come about by natural causes. But since it's in every living cell of every living thing, the evolutionist says, isn't it interesting how nature produced this by itself, by natural selection? And if you were a jury in a court case, I would say to you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if you can believe that, I've got a bridge I want to sell you in the Everglades that doesn't exist. Because it's unbelievable. And if you can believe that, I can convince you of anything. But that is what is believed. This language somehow came about by natural causes. The SETI organization and any other reasonable people would certainly conclude this came from an intelligent source if they got nothing but the genetic code. But folks, that doesn't begin to start to begin to think about beginning what's happening. Because there's so much more than just the genetic code. If all you had was the genetic code, nothing happens. But we know that in every living cell, the genetic code is being used at an amazing rate of speed to build proteins. Millions of them per second! And I'm going to show you how it's done, because we've figured all that out pretty much. We know how proteins are built in your cells. So, it involves transcription. That means getting the information off of the DNA. Migration, that means taking it somewhere. And translation, that means they take the information that came from there, translate it, and build a protein. Transcription, migration, translation. Every step of that process, class, requires, what do you think?
Protein.
That was very weak. May I say that again? Every step of this process, every step requires?
Protein.
Thank you. May I add a word to that? Many
proteins.
Exactly right. Many proteins. You can't make this happen without proteins. Used to, back in the 60s, they would say at least 50 macromolecular components. Sounds good, doesn't it? 50 proteins. At least. Now we know it's well over 150 that are required to build one protein. It's beyond belief. For example, just to make this DNA unzip, you have to have RNA polymerase, which is a
protein.
Good job. And by the way, have you ever had trouble zipping up? Did your zipper ever get stuck? Yes. Did you know that can happen to DNA? It can, trying to zip back up, it can have a problem. Did you know there's a special protein just to help it zip back up? There is. It's not RNA polymerase. It's another one. That's just illustrations. And I'm going to go down here because I'm going to forget it later. You see these little guys? This is transfer RNA. Also coded in the DNA. Here's ribosomal RNA. Also, I'm not even talking about those. But every one of these transfer RNAs is specific to a particular amino acid, and they have a specific associated with them to make the 20 amino acids be able to come in and bond. So there's 20 specific proteins, one for each transfer RNA, to make the amino acid come from the cytoplasm in there and build the protein. That's another 20. Besides the transfer RNA, besides the ribosomal RNA, which we're not even going to talk about. You ready? I'm counting on you. What's that? Oh, I got too rambunctious, didn't I? Let's see here. I don't want the batteries coming out. Then it'll die on me. All right, now I'm coming down here, and he's going to work that. So what you're going to get now is a little video clip. Don't go anywhere yet. This is a video clip you can go watch online if you like. It's on YouTube. It came out of this book right here. The advertisement for this book on their website had this little video clip on it. But it's also on YouTube. So you can go look at it as many times as you want. And they have a little monologue underneath it. I'm going to be the monologue because I'm better. So we're blanking out the monologue. And he's going to stop it every time I want him to stop it. Instantaneously, right? I mean instantaneously. Now, I know you can't hear my voice in an instant. But you can hear it enough to stop when I need you to, okay? All right, class. Let's look at building proteins. So here we go. There is the DNA. Stop. Whew, a little too slow. Because sometimes they're going to be really sensitive. But all right, here we go. You see this DNA strand wrapped around itself? Isn't that beautiful? This is a cartoon, of course. You understand that. All right, and you see the cross pieces. You see the G and the C and the T and the A and the G and the C and so on. This is before it's unzipped, right? So inside the DNA, an A always marries a T and a G always marries a C, always. And you have a sequence inside of it. By the way, they're not labeled A, C, G, and T inside there. They are chemicals that have certain features. That's just for us. All right, go ahead now. So here's the DNA, and what's going to happen now as we go along here and we are strolling along with our DNA, then pretty soon here we're going to see the DNA start to unzip. Boop, stop right there. You see that little blob? By the way, you see all those different colors? There's a pink and a brown and a yellow and a green. They're not that color, but it's colored to show you that this is made up of a glob of different proteins. A part of that blob is RNA polymerase, which is a
protein.
And then there are several other
proteins
all riding along the rib of the DNA. And if they didn't, it would never unzip and allow you to get the code off and copy it and go do something with it. May I pause here and just ask you a quick question? How do you think RNA polymerase is built? The same way. RNA polymerase is coded on the DNA, right? But folks, it takes RNA polymerase to read the code. Are you with me? How'd you get the first one? It takes the RNA polymerase to read the code to do the rest of the stuff to get the RNA polymerase built. This is a problem. And it is for all of those 150 proteins that are used to make one protein. It's a problem. Okay, let's go on. Now you see it riding up and down, or actually riding in one direction. It rides precisely in one direction. Okay, go ahead. So here we go, and there's another piece coming up. You see how that fit nicely together? All right, so it's riding along here. Stop. Did you see those? It's got wings. Amazing stuff. And you understand this is a cartoon. But the idea is there. And so down inside of here is where all the action's taking place. Okay, let's go on. All right, stop. Now this is really more kind of what it looks like, if it really looked like that. I mean, it's a bunch of chemicals. And down inside, you're making the copy. And see this little thing coming out here? That's the messenger RNA that's being made. All right? Now we're going to go down inside and we're going to look at what's happening. Okay, let's go. Down inside. There it is. Stop right there. So here you see the DNA unzipped and you see the exposed sides. And remember that three of those make a word, right? So what's happening now is, as those are exposed, you now are bringing in the bases that are complementary to each of these, and you're gradually building the messenger RNA down inside. Every time it sees a G, it brings in a C. Every time it sees an A, help me class, this is not proteins, it brings in a U. It'd be a T, but it's U on RNA, remember? And every time it sees a T, it brings in an A, and so on. Good. Let's go on. Let's watch it. So you see, one at a time, it's building this copy. And every three of those makes a word. Stop right there. You know one of the problems with this cartoon? It's way too slow. Because what you're seeing right there happens at an enormous rate. Down inside the RNA polymerase blob. It's going fast, people. How fast? Watch. That was way too slow. This happens in micromilliseconds as it builds the messenger RNA. Go ahead. All right, see, they're trying to speed it up to give you some idea. It's way just pitiful. All right, now, once it's all built, stop. It has now released the messenger RNA. Now, but how do we know how long that messenger RNA is going to be? Because there's a code here at this end that says, start reading. There's a code here at that end that says, stop reading. And the chain in between makes the chain of amino acids for that particular protein. May I say that again? That messenger RNA is for one specific protein that has its own specific sequence of amino acids. Okay? That's transcription. Should we say a lot more about that? Of course we should. We go on. Now we're going to migrate. So here we go. We're migrating through the... Stop! The cytoplasm of the nucleus. It comes to the wall of the nucleus. Do you think any respectable nucleus is just going to let anything pass through its wall? Of course not. Only certain things can pass through the wall. So it comes upon openings. So go ahead and be careful to stop when I tell you. Keep going. Now watch. You see that little thing right there? Stop. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a...
protein.
Good job. It's the guardian of the gate. And as the messenger RNA comes up to the protein, it says, welcome. You may proceed. Whereafter it closes down and doesn't allow the next guy through. But it's a very selective protein that allows the migration outside the nuclear wall. That's deserving of at least three lectures. But it's a...
protein.
Exactly right. All right, let's go on. So you see, the messenger RNA is welcomed. It opens up so nicely and is now passing through, taking the information from the nucleus where most of the DNA is, and now stop right there. You see it coming out the other side of the nuclear wall here and migrating into the cytoplasm of the cell, carrying the information. What I haven't told you is there's about three or four more proteins that are involved in that process. Okay? Let's go on now. So here we go. It's migrating, and now it comes down here, and it is being picked up now by an organelle called, stop right there, the ribosome, a two-part piece that kind of closes in on the messenger RNA and proceeds to read the information. Did you know you had things in your cell that can read? You do. And they can read better than you can. Especially in terms of speed. If you've ever taken speed reading, you're not anywhere near as good as these guys. They can speed read. But what happens is the messenger RNA comes in here and this thing closes in on it, and then down inside it reads the information off of this, translates it, and builds a protein. And I speak about that in such blithe terms. It's utterly amazing, people. What's happening? Every millisecond. You wonder why you get tired just sitting there listening to me? Your body is building thousands of proteins every second. You better be eating your amino acids. Okay, let's go. There's the ribosome closing in. And now, down inside the ribosome, stop right there. Here is the messenger RNA with the three-letter words. You see them? Do you see that transfer RNA? Does that look like a shield? What's that? What does that look like to you? Huh? Anyway. Do you see it's got three little things on the top? Those are the exact mirror images of those three. And the code on the transfer RNA is the reflection of that code, which allows it to pick up the exact correct amino acid and bring it in there. So there sits the amino acid. But notice, it's at a distance from the code because it's the transfer RNA that carries the code that picks up that amino acid that hooks it to this that makes the chain. When it finishes with that one, here comes the next one, which has the code to exactly match those three, which brings in, let's go ahead a little bit now. There it is, and you see, stop. When that one hooked up, it had at its base the amino acid that goes with that three-letter code, which then hooks to these two in a polypeptide bond, which makes a polypeptide molecule. And when you have a string of amino acids, polypeptide molecular structure, you have a protein. So what you're watching, class, in cartoon style, is how you build proteins in your cell. One amino acid at a time, following the code. You know what amazes me? That biology and biochemistry teachers teach this stuff as if there's nothing to it. You ought to be sitting there in awe that this happens. And think about the question. Could this have come about by Darwin's natural selection acting on natural variations over millions of years? Do you really believe that? I don't. I think it's a myth. It's a modern-day fairy tale. But people believe it with all their heart. So much so, they're willing to carry placards to stop the creationists. Are we talking Bible here? No, folks, we're talking science. It's the testimony of the natural world which God has allowed us to unleash in the last 50 years, unlike anything we've ever known before. And I say to you, you look at that and you still can be so stubborn and mule-headed you don't see it. All right, I told you what the problem with these cartoons are. Keep going. He tries to make it look something reasonable by speeding this up. Come on, guys, that is too slow. Move it. Move it. Stop. So they're trying to show you how fast this happens. So I have a question for you. There are lots of different kinds of proteins in living things, lots of them. On average, do you have any idea, on average, roughly how many amino acids are in a string for one protein? On average? Anybody want to venture a guess? The answer is not protein. I'm asking you, how many amino acids does it take to build an average protein? That's a good guess. And 150 if you exclude a lot of the really big ones. But the average is over 1,000. There's a bunch of proteins that have tens of thousands of amino acids. And they're built this way. Well, that would take a year to build. No, you know how long it takes? These proteins are built at an enormous rate of speed. One amino acid at a time, making peptide bonds till it's eventually all built. Okay, go. All right, stop. There is the messenger RNA coming out. You see down here this little blob? That's the protein that's being built. as it comes out of the ribosome, while the information is being read, translated, and stored in such a way that you're building the protein. And you know exactly how that happened. What I didn't tell you is there's about 30 or 40 proteins involved in this process, each of which is also built this way. All right, let's go on. So here we go. As they finish up reading and the protein is finalized, and boom, it's stop. There he is. That protein, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly, let's just say, 150 amino acids long. And it has the precise order of amino acids required for that protein. You remove one of those amino acids, you've messed up the protein. You replace it with a different amino acid, you have a different protein. Are you listening? This is specified information. But it's not finished. If all you had was a string of amino acids, you say that's a protein. No, it isn't. That's the precursor to a functioning protein. You have to have the right strand. That's not enough. Did you notice it was folding up on itself as it came out? Because of the type of strand it is, it naturally folds up into a certain shape. So it has a primary structure, that's the string. It has a secondary structure, that's its natural folding. But that's not all, class. Keep going. Because now that protein's got to go into a special organelle inside the cell, which closes it in. And in that organelle, it starts reshaping itself. You see this? Why does that happen? Because of chemistry, class. There's chemical explanations for that. You get it shaping, reshaping, coordinating around until finally it gets in the proper shape. Boom, stop. It does not turn white. And look like an angel. But all that's saying is now it has finished forming its tertiary structure. Every protein has a primary, secondary, and tertiary structure. And listen to me, class. It will not work till all of that's done. And the process built in does all that for you and then releases the protein, thank you, out into the cytoplasm to do the work for which it was, may I say it, designed. And I don't know how you could believe anything else. And so there it goes to do the work for which it was designed. If this were a court case, I think I could stop right here and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, are you convinced somebody intelligent designed that? And if not, why not? Look at what I've shown you. There's a language that exists in all living things. We have learned to decode and read that language. That means it makes sense. There's sensibility to it. It has information packed within it. That information is used at an enormous rate of multiple times per milliseconds to build stuff that you couldn't survive without. Henry Ford, in his factories to build cars, hasn't touched top side or bottom of what your cell does every second. And you can believe Darwin's explanation of how life originated and this process began. If you can believe that, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you need your head examined. But I haven't even started. We haven't even started. Okay, can you get me back to my slides? Did he do a great job or what? Thank you so much. I couldn't have done it without you. And now we're back to that one. Thank you so much. I have to just tell you a couple more things before we get out of this. Here they're being copied. You remember that? Here's the messenger RNA. Do you see those little white spots in there? Do you see that the mature messenger RNA has removed those or put them at the end? Listen, there's so much to tell you about this thing right here. I wish I could talk to you because, see, in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, we started learning a whole bunch more about this stuff. And what we've learned is that the messenger RNA has sections in it that do not code for proteins. They're called introns. The brown part are called extrons. The introns are snipped out, and it's matured by putting together the important parts, or so they would say, and then it migrates. But it has to be edited first. So what about those introns right there? Big questions. And questions started arising. And I'm not going to answer those right now. But they did start arising. And what we started learning is this DNA, a whole bunch of it, is not coding for proteins. This whole thing I just showed you that is so incredibly amazing, a whole lot of the DNA isn't being used for that. So what's it for? Going outside here as it migrates and picks up by the ribosomes and builds the proteins, there's so much more to tell you about all of that. A living cell is a marvel of detail and complex architecture. I'm going to interrupt that and say this is Carl Sagan in Life, Encyclopedia Britannica in 1974. It's 44 years ago. Seen through a microscope, there's an appearance of almost frenetic activity. On a deeper level, it is known that molecules are being synthesized at an enormous rate. Almost any enzyme, which is a catalyzes the synthesis of more than 100 other molecules per second. In 10 minutes, a sizable fraction of the total mass of the metabolizing bacterial cell has been synthesized. The information content of a simple cell has been estimated around 10 to the 12th bits, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It doesn't have many pictures. That was in 1974. What that should say now is the information content of a simple cell contains enough information for 20 billion pages of Encyclopedia Britannica. And frenetic activity, you know what frenetic is? That's frenetic. Over 200,000 molecules are being built every second in your cells. And you have billions of cells. If we received a message from outer space containing the genetic code and an explanation of how it was used to build proteins, everyone would conclude the source was intelligent. Don't fool yourself. Is it reasonable to believe intelligent design in this scientific age? I will tell you, with Darwin's black box author, Dr. Michael Behe, everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things look like they are made. Everywhere you look, there's a loud, clear, piercing cry of design. That's the title of this series, taken straight out of Michael Behe's book. If you don't have that book, you get it and get the later version. 10 years after he wrote it, he wrote another one. And his message was, the case is worse for the evolutionists than it was 10 years ago. Everywhere you look, you see design. Isn't the most natural and logical conclusion of that that there is a designer behind all of this? But I closed this morning by saying to you, what about junk DNA? Who in this class has heard something about junk DNA? A few. That's my topic for in the morning. And I'm going to tease you. This is my commercial. The fact is, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, we began to discover that a whole lot of the DNA was not used for building proteins. In fact, it started looking like there's a bunch of junk in there, left over from your evolutionary past. Or so it was interpreted. You think God would make a bunch of junk? I don't think so. And I will tell you, as a creationist, I first learned about this in the early 90s, and it was very disturbing. I didn't know how to answer this stuff. I knew one thing for sure, God doesn't make junk. So why is there so much junk? That's our topic for tomorrow. Don't you miss it.